Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello, and welcome to a very special Quarren Stream edition of The Cinema Clash. I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net, joined as always remotely these days by Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com. Hey, Charlie.
It is indeed a special episode, not only because there's a thunderstorm going on outside right now, and I honestly hope it picks up thunder. That'd be great. But we've had guests on the show before. We've brought them over to my studio basement and my chairs, and we've sat around and discussed. We've had Christian Hammaker, we've had Artie Chicken. Now we have a guest I've never met before. This is the ultimate Quarren Stream, the ultimate remote guest. We have a guest, Hannah, I've never met before. Who am I talking to?
It is my college friend, longtime Cinema Clash fan, Brett Sonnenschein, coming to us live from New York. Brett, are you there?
I am here. I am on curfew and in New York and glad to be on Cinema Clash.
Great. And so how long do you think you've been listening?
A very long time. At least a year or so, right? I mean, I think I'm a pretty early adopter.
We've been doing this, honestly, for probably like close to 5 years, but we weren't always on iTunes. And so I think a lot of people kind of got familiar with us once they had that on-demand option. Charlie, you've never met Brett, but in reality, I think Brett may be closer to your perspective on a lot of films than mine.
Which is fine, because Brett, I'm not going to take it easy on it, even though this is your first.
Okay.
I'm going to throw you right into the fire. This clash watched one fiction film this week and three documentaries. I did not watch the fiction film. You and Hannah did. Shirley, starring Miss Elizabeth Moss, who I consider one of our current contemporary generation's best actresses. I mean, remember last year in The Kitchen, a terrible, an awful film, and I still nominated her as one of my favorite best supporting actresses. She was so good. Brett, tell me about Shirley, and specifically tell me about Elizabeth Moss.
Well, Elizabeth Moss is the title character in Shirley, a fictionalized story about the great writer Shirley Jackson. And she plays a somewhat off-the-wall, dangerous-to-know character in a college town in Vermont, married to her husband, Stanley, played by Michael Stuhlbarg. And they take in a graduate student and his wife to board with them. And crazy things happen.
Hijinks and or shenanigans?
Yeah. I think it's important to note, though, that Elizabeth Moss is the best part of this film. Would you agree with that, Brett?
I think she is the best part. It is also a beautifully shot film. I love the lush colors. I loved the feel of being in Vermont in a hot, sticky summer. I love those parts of it. I wasn't so much crazy about the story. I thought we got into Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and then things just got crazier and crazier.
Yeah, and this film does have an obvious homage to Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It's very, very clear. It's one of those films that actually is pretty well critically received. It premiered at Sundance. It won a special jury prize in auteur filmmaking, which should have been my first clue that I probably would not really like it.
My ears anytime, just perked up.
Exactly. Hey, Charlie, who's the other auteur that I have an issue with?
Oh, God, there's so many.
It's mostly like a Terrence Malick, which just doesn't rise to that. But you know, I was not familiar with Shirley Jackson as a writer. I just never read her stuff. Horror writing is just not the genre that I'm into. But this... this is a weird, it's just a weird film. And I,
it's very strange.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a strange house that they live in. It's very, I feel it's kind of out of time. I think the movie is set in the 1960s, but it looks like the 1940s. It's also a fictionalized version. Shirley Jackson, who I have to say is one of my favorite writers. I mean, I love so many of her books and short stories. She had children. She did not seem to be quite as dangerous and manipulative as Elizabeth Moss is in this movie.
Yeah, the film is set in the last year of what actually was Jackson's life. She died in 1965 and she was only 48. And she, in reality, she had four kids. There are no kids in this film that she has. And so it kind of leaves you wondering how they made these choices as to what would be fictional and what would not. And it's about like how she sacrifices herself and her dreams and her freedom for marriage to this philanderer. And then there's this codependency going on with her philandering husband. And so the only thing I can say is what I found really amazing is when I went to look up a little bit of information about Shirley Jackson, the picture of the real Shirley Jackson is pretty spot on with how Elizabeth Moss looks and portrays her in this film. Was impressive.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty. She really has this sort of feel about her, even though, you know, Shirley Jackson, I think physically was a very different body type than Elizabeth Moss. But there's just something about the way she carries herself in her face. It just looks like Shirley Jackson.
Yeah. And so, I mean, overall, this is this one is just going to appeal to, I would still guess, more skewed towards an art house crowd or to somebody maybe who has actually read some Shirley Jackson material and is curious. But I don't know.
Yeah, not Brett, do you have to, like, so it's a little lost on Hannah. You can't go in here knowing I don't know who Shirley Jackson is. Let me watch this Shirley Jackson film. I've only read The Lottery.
Okay.
Do you have to know of who a little bit about Shirley Jackson to really enjoy this film?
I think it would help to know, but on the other hand, I would say it's such a fictionalized version that I think if you're going, oh, I want to see the person who wrote The Haunting of Hill House and the person who wrote We've Always Lived in the Castle, I don't think you're going to get that person. I think you're going to get someone who's in the imagination of the screenwriter and the director, because you're not going to get the actual Shirley Jackson story.
I wish I could just like go back and like read the press notes or watch an interview or something of this guy. Why like would you make a movie of Orwell or F. Scott Fitzgerald and make it just fictional? You know, they lived juicy enough lives as they were. Why you gotta write a script about it?
Well, hey, I did read the press notes, just so you know. And
did Josephine Decker say what was going on there?
She, yeah. So first of all, it's the screenplay was by this woman, Sarah Gubbins, based on this novel by Susan Scarfe Merrill. And the director's statement says, Shirley Jackson was a wildly unorthodox human and storyteller. And so they were trying to be like her, daring, intimate, structured yet dreamlike, and they wanted the film to feel that same way in story and cinematography and such. And the writer basically describes how she tried to sort of take what the director was looking for as well, and that's what we got, was this picture of a wildly unorthodox human. And I asked Brett at the end, I was like, I don't really understand what exactly we saw there at the end.
I think there's a trade-off or a message at the end that I didn't fully understand.
I don't quite see what they're trying to say there. Yeah. I kind of got where they were meaning to go, but I didn't go with them. And this one, just so folks can find it if they do care to look, it's available for streaming on Hulu, some virtual cinemas, and most major video on demand platforms. And it will also be playing at some select drive-in theaters. So if a few drive-ins happen to have opened up around you, but don't take the kids at all.
That's going to be a weird movie to see in a drive-in.
Yeah, yes, you know what this, I agree. It sounds like last year's film that took liberties. It's a different tone, obviously. It took liberties with Emily Dickinson is Wild Nights with Enemy with Emily with Molly Shannon is what this sounds like.
Yeah, but I liked Wild Nights with Emily actually was better. I enjoyed that one more. This one is disturbing. And so you just have to be okay with this very bizarre, disturbing tale.
Speaking of bizarre, let's move to the documentaries. Well, there's three documentaries we're going to talk about. And I found, and they each in their own way have very bold claims. So they have some convincing to do. I need some supporting evidence for them to back up each of their claims. And two of them did. Including the first one I want to talk about, which is called You Don't Know Me. September 22nd, 1995. Now, since you two know each other and you go back and you already cracked an age joke at me before we even started this podcast, I'm going to make both y'all feel old right now. September 22nd, 1995, I was still, you know, just fresh into my sophomore year of high school.
Ouch.
Oh, my God.
Are you saying we were not hanging out in 1995?
Brett and I were already out of school. We went to Northwestern together, and we were well into our working years by then.
I was living in Los Angeles working for a company that made comic books, and it was one of the worst years of my life.
Well, high school was no picnic that year either.
Yeah, well, I'll give you that.
It's been 25 years. It's been a quarter of a century since that comic book year, Brett. And in September 1995, Paul Verhoeven released a notorious film called Showgirls. Every high school boy wanted to see it. We couldn't see it because it was rated NC-17. No one was getting in there. So I don't even think I saw Showgirls until college when I rented it, like kind of sheepishly going, okay, I want to watch Showgirls, you know, auteurs and such. So
run a Blockbuster.
Yeah. Jeffrey McHale, the director, this is his debut feature film. And he is waxing nostalgic, but he's on a mission. America, the globe, the world misunderstood Showgirls. They didn't get it. They mocked it. They made fun of it. The horrible acting, the terrible script. Nothing made sense. The story. He says, no. It's actually borderline genius. That is his bold claim. Showgirls, he's going to make it into a cult film. It's misunderstood. Celebrate its awfulness is what he says. He compares the stage numbers in Showgirls to Cecil B. DeMille and Busby Berkeley. I love these bold claims, and he mostly backs them up. He actually shows them side by side, and they look very similar. He has this tangent where Nomi Malone, Elizabeth Berkley, is like Judy Garland. Okay, that doesn't really work for me. He weaves in scenes from Verhoeven's other films like RoboCop, Total Recall, Starship Troopers. He has Arnold Schwarzenegger actually watching Showgirls on the wall. It's pretty funny. Hannah, this documentary worked for me.
I know it did. And you know that it did not work for me. And I don't feel like I even needed to have gone back and watched Showgirls, which I did not ever have a chance to see. But I think I was, quote unquote, exposed to more than enough of what was probably in that film in this documentary. I think I discovered that the things that I've always liked least about a Paul Verhoeven movie are the very things that make his movies his movies. And so this was a prime example. I think it bodes well for a movie like Cats becoming a cult classic in the years ahead, except maybe they'd have to repaint the cats nude. I don't know. But it swept the Razzies for a reason, that film. And so I kept watching because I was just kind of floored by the attempts at defending Showgirls as anything more than basically poor to its core with a little bit of maybe an extra layer of story thrown in there and leveraging the fact that Elizabeth Berkley was, you know, best known at the time. She had been on Saved by the Bell, which is one of those sitcoms I never really got into because we were older.
No, we're not. I was the perfect age demographic for Saved by the Bell.
You were the perfect age demographic. But in this film, in this documentary, we actually hear Elizabeth Berkley claiming that her character in Showgirls was a natural extension of her character.
No,
from
that's ridiculous, because Elizabeth Berkley, she got fed to the wolves on this. You know, Verhoeven came out pretty bad. Kyle MacLachlan skated. Gina Gershon skated. It's Elizabeth Berkley who just really took it. I mean, you really haven't seen her since. And it's not her fault. Verhoeven told her to overact. He told her to do it. She gave him the performance he asked for. And now, I never thought about Showgirls as anything good. I mocked it right along with the best of them, which is why I think this documentary works, is because it has me defending it. I sound like a convert here. Yes, I accept this cult leader. I'm now an acolyte here. I think it's hard. The jury, I guess, is out on whether or not you need to know who Shirley Jackson is to enjoy Shirley. To enjoy this documentary, to really get anything out of it, you have to know the source material. It's like watching The Disaster Artist without ever having seen The Room. Yes, you can make fun of Tommy Wiseau, but you don't really understand what he's agonizing about with, I did not. You just don't get it unless you've seen the movie.
Hey, I love those two films, so it's hard for me to make that comparison. I don't know, Brett, recall seeing Showgirls?
I saw Showgirls. I didn't see it when it originally came out, because this is a movie that from day one had a reputation as one of the all-time turkeys. And yeah, I think I caught it on cable one night. I didn't think it was that bad, but I didn't think it was particularly good. But this was really kind of had that kind of status of The Room for a few years before other bad movies kind of took over in the public conscience, or quote bad movies, as Charlie might say now.
This is becoming sort of a Rocky Horror. Rocky Horror was annihilated when it was released, and now it's embraced and loved and midnight movied to death. And Showgirls is becoming midnight movied. There are crowds that show up and chant and clap and cheer. It seems a little forced how you try to force a cult movie to take off, but I think it's working.
But you have to acknowledge that there is a lot of nudity and sex in that film.
There's supposed to be. It's. I loved his argument of there is nothing sexy about this highly sexual film. Nothing.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I gotta. Yeah,
and that's probably one of the reasons people celebrate it. Like, look at this. Look at all this nudity. There's nudity all over the place, and it's. And even my 18-year-old self, who saw this, who wanted to watch it for the nudity, was probably turned off by it. Like, ooh, too much nudity. Take it away.
All right. Well, I can't wait till your little boys decide that this is a film that they want to see. And they ask daddy to, hey, do you have that You Don't Know Me documentary?
Denied.
And the original Showgirls?
Denied.
But also, I think you need to let folks know that Nomi is spelled N-O-M-I, the character in that film. So when we say, hey, if you want to check out the future cult classic Showgirls and its companion documentary, You Don't Know Me is N-O-M-I.
I thought this was going to be about Klaus Nomi, the singer from the 70s and 80s, and I was a little disappointed to find out it wasn't about him.
Can you imagine if people went and thought that that's what they were going to see?
Nobody's going to make that mistake. But you can see You Don't Know Me on demand and on digital release on 9 June. So it's actually not out right now, but on 9 June next week, you can start paying money to watch You Don't Know Me. And I guarantee you there will be people that line up to do that.
If it's not out till next week, why were we already discussing it?
Because it's out before next Friday, Hannah.
You had to make me watch it early. Okay.
I need the time to watch Showgirls.
Well, let's watch one that we have all seen, all three of us, and that's already out that anyone can see because it's on Netflix, and I'm talking about Spelling the Dream. And here's another bold claim. Why have Indian American competitors won the Scripps National Spelling Bee for the past 12 years? Hannah, does the documentary Spelling the Dream answer that question adequately?
I think so. I found it very interesting. It's not groundbreaking, because we've certainly noticed over the years that the spelling bee is dominated by Indian Americans, but it was nice to sort of understand why that is. And so this is a sports documentary, and family friendly. And so I found it interesting, if not you know, not groundbreaking, but just you learn about the immigrant dream, how the relaxation of immigration rules in 1965 paved the way for these families that are in America and that have these kids that that just have latched onto the spelling bee as something that is their, it's their Super Bowl, it's their Olympics, and they put me to shame. I mean, when I'm watching that these kids spell these words that I have no idea what they mean, it was quite something. I don't know, Brett, did you learn anything?
It was interesting to see how culturally significant the spelling bee had become to Indian Americans. And it was nice to see, you know, all these supportive parents and these well-adjusted kids who were doing well. It wasn't like they were being, you know, forced into it. The problem that I had was it's spelling. And I couldn't be sold on, I mean, it's not like it's math or they're just memorizing spelling. I mean, I never liked it in school. My daughter was a bad speller, but she did well in school. I just was like, I just kept thinking, but it's just spelling.
Charlie, was that what you got out of it?
Well, I made my 7-year-old watch it and, you know, it felt like homework to him. The director, Sam Riga, he trots out the two Indian Americans everybody knows, and they're from CNN, Sanjay Gupta and Fareed Zakaria. And they're saying, no, it's not because of Indian genetics. Okay. We're not predisposed to be good spellers because of our DNA. And then they say, it's not because of tiger parenting. You know, we're not breathing down their necks, forcing them to spell for 8 hours a day. And then the ruler comes out when they fall asleep. No, it's not that either. So what is it? Community appreciation? I'm not sure at all. In fact, I don't think it did. The film does not answer the question. Why do Indian Americans win the spelling bee? We still don't know. We don't know. It's just quirky. Embrace the quirk, but we don't know.
I don't know. I mean, it had shades of the 2002 Oscar-nominated documentary Spellbound, which I think was better. But
oh yeah, that's,
you know,
a great
this
movie.
Is good, right? But this is good for this next for a new generation. And it also had a little bit of that the family drama Akilah and the Bee from 2006. And so this is sort of a different chapter of that same story. And I'll tell you what, I think what got me or why I'm a little more empathetic to what this documentary is trying to do is that I felt so bad at the end for all these kids understanding now that that they'd be in their final, for a lot of kids, they run out of eligibility at a certain age. And this would have been the final year of eligibility for some who were, you know, who just always were looking forward to the next year. And because of the pandemic, the 2020 B was canceled. And all those kids who worked so hard, and you see just how much this means to them. I just felt terrible for those who miss out on their opportunity for what might have been their final shot.
That would have been a better documentary. The documentary about that.
Well, maybe they'll work on it because maybe they were to some degree keeping tabs on the kids that they do feature in that documentary.
My favorite kid was that the guy who actually had composure, Shrav Dasari. He was, you know, the guy in the hoodie, the lucky hoodie. He was great. He was good.
Cool. Yeah, but that's it. I felt these were characters. I really felt you got some sense of who these people were as characters. There was the little kid, you know, that you didn't know.
He
was obnoxious, but that's what you could tell. So he was designed to be the obnoxious one, but he's little. He was like 8 years old with his feet dangling from the chair.
I just want to squirt him with a squirt bottle. Tell him to calm down.
We all know kids like that.
Yeah, we do all know kids like that. And so... But talented, incredibly talented and smart to know I think one of the comedians that's a talking head in this, you know, he jokes about some of the backlash and he's like, you know, don't blame us for knowing the English language better than the rest of you. And it's true. It's like they learn the language and so it puts us all to shame.
It does. They're just great.
Yeah. I mean, I was never sold though that it was, are they learning the language or were they just memorizing a bunch of words? I mean,
no, that's
man's got
true.
A point. Yeah. Man's got a point.
He does.
I mean, that's the
he
way
does.
I look
I
at
mean,
spelling.
They definitely reveal, but that's part of this film too, is that they reveal some quote unquote trade secrets as to how they do go about mastering 500,000 words.
And but forget the subject. It's about how it's about it. And it's a little, it's, you're right. It is no Spellbound. It's dry. I mean, it's a, it's, it, it comes across as toast.
The next one you're going to talk about, I think it'll be interesting to know whether or not you feel more.
Well, the next one convinced me. I went in, I didn't know. I've never heard of it. I know in motorsports in this country, NASCAR wins. Everyone, all the guys watch NASCAR and a little bit of IndyCar. Globally, they don't watch, it's like soccer. They don't watch American football and they certainly don't watch NASCAR. They watch Formula One. I've heard of Formula One. I've seen it on television. It's on at odd hours because they're always in Australia or Hong Kong or someplace weird. This is about Formula E. I was like, okay, that must be like the fifth level of Formula One. It's not. It's Formula Electric. Electric car racing as the world, as Tesla and other companies manufacture and get the general public to drive electric cars. That is the wave of the future. All car manufacturers are developing and manufacturing electric cars. So why wouldn't the racing world embrace the same technology? They're talking, the founder talks about climate change and air pollution. And he says, hey, electric car racing was either going to be invented by a racer or environmentalists. And he was a racer. He's like, I know this is going to be the future. Now, of course, there's an inferiority complex. We're racing electric car batteries that make no sound. There's no vroom, vroom, vroom. It's like, so they get made fun of by all the other drivers. This is convincing. It convinced me that this is the wave of the future. Not only that, this has smash. It was produced by your boy, Hannah, Leonardo DiCaprio.
When does he show up? Because I'll tell you, I know you you wanted me to watch this, and I really intended to. I got through about 20 minutes, and I didn't leave the documentary just out of out of disgust at the documentary. I just ran out of time. But in the 20 minutes I watched, though, I was not really pulled in, and I don't think in that first 20 minutes that I did. Does Leo show up?
He does. He comes in about halfway. And you never really get to see him. He's got sunglasses on, his hat pulled down, but he talks. He's got his own, he's actually talking about the fuel, and you can actually taste the fuel that they put into these cars. It's that spurs the generators. Not that I would taste it. I'm just saying Leo tastes it. But this is the sports documentary, not the spelling one. This has the top drivers and the founder and the underdogs and the rivalries, and the Brazilians don't like the Frenchman and the Frenchman doesn't like the Brit. And this is, they get each other under each other's skin and they needle each other, just like real race car drivers do. I forwarded the trailer. I don't even think we've said the title yet, And We Go Green. I forwarded the trailer to And We Grow Green to our executive producer, Joe Bordeaux in St. Pete. St. Petersburg, Florida hosts a Formula One race every year. Got postponed this year. Looks like it's going to happen in October. And I said, Joe, you are the guy who could bring Formula E to St. Petersburg. He said, you know what? Why not? He forwarded the trailer to the mayor's chief of staff. And, he says, St. Petersburg bills itself as the sustainable city. It seems this would be a perfect fit for Formula E. And I think the Cinema Clash just might have brought Formula E to Florida.
That's amazing. I hope we're invited to like throw down the flag or whatever. Is that how they start their races?
Well, I'll tell them I'll throw down the flag and you get to go meet Leo.
That works for me, but it is. I do have
maybe we can
another
sponsor it.
Yeah, we'll even let Brett come since he was on this particular clash. But I what's interesting to me though is that it's directed by Fisher Stevens, who did The Cove, and written by a former coworker of mine, Mark Monroe, who I believe also maybe was the writer on The Cove, and so I probably will go back and finish it, but it still seems to me, from what I watched at the beginning, that it's still very much a niche documentary that environmentalists will potentially flock to it, and sustainability. Hey, if you want to really inject some speed into your sustainability courses at college, this might be a fun film to show. But the story did not bring me in. I had never heard of Formula E.
Nobody has.
Nobody has.
Hannah, you got to be careful reviewing a film that you've only seen 20 minutes of. No, you're going to take fire.
I'm not. No, that's what I'm saying. I will go back and watch the rest of it. But I'm just saying that I think when you haven't heard of it, and it has been around now for several years, it's very interesting that it's been around and we still are it's just not part of the sports world that I've seen at all. And especially when you think about all the racing films that have been out over the past few years, that have really kind of excited, you know, more for the NASCAR fans and things. I just found it interesting. This premiered at the 2019 Cannes film, and it was at the film festival, and it was at Toronto. And yet I still don't recall hearing any buzz about it at the time.
No, it's not a great documentary. That's why it's going to premiere on Hulu, which it just did today. So anyone who wants to go see it with a Hulu subscription can go fill themselves in. No, I've never heard of Formula E, and I'm glad they made a documentary about it because now I have. And it's convincing. I guarantee you, I know I will see Formula E pop up on ESPN The Ocho one day. Right after, the cornhole championships.
After cornhole, yeah.
And it's cool that we'll be in the know. I do always like that. That's one of the things and one of the reasons we do often watch and showcase these documentaries that might otherwise just kind of fall by the wayside is because for the very reason that I like that element of the spelling documentary that I found interesting and that I wasn't familiar with a part of that story. It's the same reason that documentaries like And We Go Green are valuable because I do think it's good to just sort of be made aware. And it's very cool when somebody finds it's hard to find something that hasn't already been around the track, so to speak, so many times already.
All right. So The Clash, not only do we have a new guest on today, but we're also going to talk, we're going to move away from not only fiction films and documentaries, we're going to talk about a television show. Just because it piqued our interest. And we're talking about Space Force, which premiered on Netflix last week. It's a comedy, half-hour comedy starring Steve Carell. All 10 episodes of it. Brett, did Space Force grab you?
Space Force did not grab me.
Oh.
I didn't like it. I thought I wasn't sure. I mean, there were funny scenes. I didn't think it was overall was that funny. I just thought it was a bunch of oddball characters. I didn't know, is Steve Carell smart? Is he stupid? Do we like Space Force? Do we don't like them? I just didn't go for it. Now, I know The Office had a pretty bad first season and it became a great show. So maybe after the episodes I saw, Space Force picked up.
Hannah, is Brett onto something or did he miss the boat?
He could be onto something, except that honestly, I watched all 10 episodes. I binged watched in batches of 5. So I watched the first 5 and then the second 5. And I can't imagine that this could come back for another season. I thought it ended, the 10 episode arc just really ends in a very disappointing fashion. And so I don't think that sitcom lightning's going to be striking twice for Steve Carell with this. I had watched the SpaceX launch before I started watching the Space Force episodes, and that reality was so much cooler than what I later saw during my binge of this fictional Space Force. But I will say, and I think Brett only watched maybe the first 2 episodes.
Yeah.
And I think the best were maybe like 3 and 4. And so somewhere in the middle, it actually picked up and had some really fun and timely themes going on. And it got better. And so my hopes were higher as I was watching it. And then somehow it lost its way again. And by the end, I just felt that it really was a misfire.
I saw 8 episodes. And personally, my favorite one was episode 3. It really does pick up.
Mine too.
Oh, I stopped.
However, I'm going to acknowledge my bias. I'm close to the Space Force. I used to, the current commander, the first commander of Space Force, I have worked for him. He used to be my boss. I have people that work for me that have already applied to join the Space Force. And it's funny to me because it's just close enough, you know, it's still absurd, but it's close enough to be like, oh yeah, that would happen. That is amusing. I think we're supposed to have empathy for Steve Carell's General Naird. He's in this situation he doesn't want to be in, but he has to lead. He has to put it all together. He's an Air Force guy. He's all about fighters and bombers. What does he know about satellites and rockets? He knows nothing, which is why he relies and has that on-again, off-again, push-and-pull relationship with Dr. Mallory, John Malkovich. And that is the one part of Space Force which kind of gets under my skin. Each episode has that arc. At the beginning, there are opposing forces. They're opposite sides. And at the end, they come together. General Naird's short-term vision, his quick wins, and Dr. Mallory's long-term vision, space is eternal. And they respect each other at the end. And at the at the beginning of the very next episode, they're on their opposite sides again. Then they have to come back together by the end of 30 minutes. That got on my nerves. But This is a funny show. And I really like Ben Schwartz as F. Tony Scarapaducci.
He's very funny. Yeah. He's always fun to watch.
Yes, as the social media guru of the group. Yeah, that was his was you could actually see elements of real people, you know, satirized, I would say, in this sitcom. But I could not imagine as I'm watching that I would have stayed with it. And certainly, Brett, you did two episodes. Can you imagine if they were broken up by commercials and a week apart, which is why this would it would have been one of those types of shows that would have been absolutely dead in the water on network television.
Yeah, probably. I heard this show called Seinfeld got off to a really bad start. They had to pull it together.
It's true, but they use Seinfeld as that reminder. But very few shows are given that opportunity anymore. And especially when you have that binge watch potential of just waiting until all the episodes are done, and then you can just you can binge. It's just people's viewing habits have changed significantly, and I don't think that anyone would have the bandwidth to wait week after week to watch this. And I don't know what would happen. I can't quite envision a season two other than to just find out why Lisa Kudrow, who plays his wife, is in prison.
That's a secret. I love it.
No, they never tell you. So you go for 10 episodes waiting to figure out what did she do that she supposedly that she was sentenced to like 40 years in prison. And so stuff like that, where I thought they'd at least throw us a little bit more of a bone about that by the end of episode 10, just in case it doesn't come back. But I felt like it jumped the shark a little bit at the end with just having these people sort of this group of people.
No, this is the kind of show that comes back. If I can have five seasons of Fuller House, you can give me a second season of Space Force.
I'll just say it's a really talented cast. So it'd be nice if they can put it together.
Yeah, that's true.
I agree, but it was also Fred Willard disappears. I mean, I know he died, but it was very kind of heart-wrenching to sort of see him in just a couple of scenes here and there, and to realize that that his character just kind of popped in, and there was no character development throughout those 10 episodes, and to know that that he's not going to be available. I can see them doing, if they come back for a second season, doing some kind of homage to him.
No way he was supposed to have character development. He's just one of the 10 million problems on Steve Carell's shoulders. He's just there to nitpick, like, oh my God, my dad is popping up at the worst possible time. His character is not supposed to be developed.
But doesn't it make you think, wow, to be that to be that funny still into his 80s and to be working have been able to pull it off.
Mm-hmm. To bring something full circle. So last week, I spent the entire episode extolling Hannah about the virtues of The Vast of Night, which I'm sure everyone has seen now. I'm sure of it, since it's been out a full 7 days on Amazon Prime Video. Well, I got our executive producer to watch it, who doesn't watch any movies, and he went to watch The Vast of Night because I said, Joe, you're going to love the radio studio and all the technology stuff and the late 50s stuff. So he sat down in Washington and he sent me a couple notes. He said, the right reel on the reel-to-reel in the studio tape recorder was going the wrong way. He said, the dress, the cars, and the studio board looked early 50s and not late 50s. So thank you for the notes, Joe.
Did he like the film?
He did like it. Yeah, he agreed. It was a very good film. He's happy that I recommended it to him. And look at all the work he's doing for us. He's watching The Mass of Night and he's in contact with the mayor's office about Formula E at the Space Force of the Limit, Hannah.
Formula E classic.
Yeah, so Brett, you haven't seen The Mass of Night yet, I take it.
No, I haven't. Well, I had to watch all these movies for this episode, so I didn't get a chance to watch it. I mean, I don't know how you two do this every week.
Yeah, you know, that is our world, but that's that brings me to an interesting thing is we do sometimes it's important to realize that you can go back and watch something that you might have missed later. And one of those films that I think is really important to watch that's being offered up for free in the month of June is the 2019 film Just Mercy about the work of civil rights attorney Bryan Stevenson. So it's the timing is right to go and see this film if you missed it the first time around. Warner Brothers has made it available for free rental on digital platforms throughout the month of June. I recommended it then when it came out, and I recommend it again if you happen to have missed it.
Yeah, I believe we praised Just Mercy in a segment when it came out, however many months ago. It's a very, very moving and actually at times very tough to watch film. It came out at the same time as similar subject matter film called Clemency, and Just Mercy was the better film. It's just the superior film, and I'm glad that it's free to watch for anyone. It's a very timely message. It's very moving, and I just don't know. Are people really gonna want more consternation in their lives? Because it's a heavy watch.
But it's heavy, but it's not that heavy. Like Clemency was heavy. Just Mercy, you know, to just realize that this guy's out there. When we talk about fiction versus fictionalized material, this is based on a real guy who's still out there fighting the good fight, and a real story about prison reform and justice reform and just the racial overtones in the system and the it really is a good choice, I think, for families to potentially watch together. And even Brett, your kids are probably the right age to kind of like this one with you guys.
Well, all right. But, we did.
Hold on. Did you have something else, Brett? In our little remote three-way here?
Oh, not about that movie. No, I have not seen it.
Anything that you wanted to add from what you've seen?
Well, what I've been seeing on my own is I'm always binging on TCM, watching what's on Noir Alley. I've been on a little bit of a British TV kick. I've been watching W1A with Hugh Bonneville from Downton Abbey, which is a workplace comedy, and Quiz, which is about a quiz show scandal on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. That happened in England in 2001, I think. It's on AMC, or you can rent it on some of the other platforms. And I recommend all of those.
Yeah, that sounds like some of those kinds of things that Charlie would watch.
You know, that's really coincidental, because you know, you say quiz show scandal and you think of 1994 quiz show, Ralph Fiennes and John Turturro. The guy in real life who busted open that scandal, the whistleblower, he just passed away this week.
I think
John Turturro's character, I believe it was
Temple.
Wow, full circle right there, man.
And it was interesting. We've had a couple of discussions over the past few weeks about theaters and when we would return. And so I just thought it was worth noting that AMC Theaters, announced this week that it has quote unquote substantial doubt that it will survive the pandemic. I wanted to get your quick take on this. I kind of felt that they were maybe floating some sort of trial balloon just to see how people respond and to see how the studios might respond. What do you guys think about AMC saying they might not be able to come back?
Yeah, I can see both sides of this coin. AMC is the world's largest theater chain. They furloughed 26,000 employees, and they furloughed the execs. They furloughed the CEO. And then they decided to get in this crazy, ridiculous tit-for-tat fight with Universal Studios over Trolls World Tour, which didn't help anybody. And now they're saying, hey, we might not come back. And all theaters are in trouble. Like, theaters aren't, they're not going to get back to where they were until like 2022. I mean, it's going to be a while. A lot of people will go back to the movies, but many, many will not until there's a full up 100% vaccine. And I can see AMC's in trouble, but are they really going to just disappear off the face of the earth? Come on.
Go ahead, Brett.
I mean, corporations really, I mean, they tend to cry wolf, but I mean, a lot of my friends who aren't as big movie fans are saying things like they're never going back to movie theaters. And I mean, I can't wait to go back to a movie theater. But mm-hmm. I think people who aren't as big movie fans aren't going to take the chance of going to a theater, like Charlie said, until there's a vaccine and people know that you can go anywhere.
Well, I think Cinemark is actually planning to test the waters a little further. I read that they're saying that they're not going to be requiring masks. And they're going to start opening up like within the next few weeks. And, but they will employ what they call some sort of seating social distance technology. And I don't know. That whole concept is kind of, a little unnerving to me that people can be sitting in a theater for 2 hours without wearing masks. But I also understand that wearing a mask for 2 hours can be very uncomfortable. But I think Cinemark, is actually going to sort of try and see what happens with what they're trying to do. And I suspect that AMC is probably going to be watching very carefully.
I've always considered Cinemark a more of a Southern theater chain. And as mm-hmm. you know, the Southern states have a more laissez-faire attitude with COVID-19. So it doesn't surprise me that, they would be the chain to say, hey, man, just no, bring a BYOB, BYOM. Yeah.
And I think they were starting in Texas, which maybe was where they were headquartered. And so we'll see. But yeah, I'm as much as I'm with Brett and would love to get back into a theater for those big tentpole summer movie type of experiences. I think we have to wait a little bit longer and just see what shakes out in the world.
Oh, well, congratulations, yeah. Brett. Yeah. You did it, man. You survived.
Yeah.
Well, it was a lot of fun. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you, Brett.
Quick wrap up. Mm-hmm. I think Brett was higher on Shirley than Hannah was.
A little bit higher.
Hannah, slightly higher. Yeah. Hannah was definitely the highest on the spelling documentary, Spelling the Dream. Hannah says that's probably the best film of the week.
No, I didn't say that.
Really? Spelling One?
I would say go back and watch Just Mercy. Watch something that actually
is
better.
That's not the film of the week, Hannah.
But I don't think any of these count as the film of the week. None of these score that high for me to be considered a film of the week. Spelling the Dream is for families. But it's not you don't know me.
No, it actually is. The best film of the week is You Don't Know Me, because as a preposterous thesis that actually carries water.
I mean, absolutely. You have told me on it. I definitely want to watch Showgirls again and see that.
And remember, if you have a Hulu description, you can also go check out the future of motorsports with End We Go Green.
And that will be a cool thing to follow. And so I will look forward to when we can actually go to St. Pete and check out the race there. So on that note, I guess we will wrap things up. On behalf of the Cinema Clash, myself, Charlie, and special guest Brett, have a great weekend, everybody, and stay safe out there.
Thank you.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.